I am in the studio with Howard Berkus, and you are here in town to receive the Tom and Pat Gish Award tonight. Talk about the honor.
Well, it's an amazing honor, actually. I have won over 40 major journalism awards in my career, but this one is right there at the top. And I'm sharing it with Ken Ward Jr. from the Charleston Gazette-Mail in West Virginia, and his mentor, the late Paul Niden, who epitomized a phrase that is used at the Charleston Gazette-Mail, which is sustained outrage. That's what guided Paul Niden in his journalism. Ken Ward Jr. learned that from him and fine-tuned it to become the amazing reporter that he is, and his focus on rural issues, especially coal mining issues over the years. And that's why we're being recognized, because of our focus on rural America, our focus on coal mining issues, in particular coal mine safety, regulatory failure, misbehavior by coal mining companies. And so as someone who spent 10 years covering rural America, has done investigative reporting involving rural America, this is a huge honor.
Can you talk a little bit about some of your experiences throughout the years covering rural America for NPR and how it might have changed a little bit?
One thing that I tried to do right off the bat when I got the beat, which was in 2003, I believe, was to, number one, travel to places I'd never been to in the country. I'd spent 20 years covering the American West. I was really familiar with the West and the rural parts of the West and had done a lot of stories. So I ended up, you know, coming to the Southeast, where I had not really spent much time, rural parts of the Northeast and the Midwest and Appalachia. And one thing that I quickly discovered was that many rural places, all of the ones that I visited, had people in them who care deeply about those places, who thought deeply about how to keep those places going, despite the challenges that they might face, and were trying to figure out what can we do to help our local community survive. I don't have a rural background myself. I grew up in a suburb outside of Philadelphia. My wife's family, they're all rural. They're farmers from North and South Dakota. So I have some, you know, connection with rural in that way. But that was helpful as a journalist to identify people like that. And it also contradicts a lot of, you know, the stereotypes about rural places. And that's one thing I kept finding over and over again, that the stereotypes about rural America were that and didn't really apply to every place I went to, no matter how small, no matter how remote.
And you were working, of course, on the most recent story, of course, the coal's deadly dust, and some of that, a lot of it was used for the PBS program Frontline. Talk a little bit about that investigation as well.
This started in 2016. I had done some reporting before that on the resurgence of black lung disease in Appalachia in 2012. And then in 2016, I got a tip that there was an epidemic, actually, or what turned out to be an epidemic of the worst stage of black lung disease, which is called progressive massive fibrosis, also in Appalachia. And in 2016, I was able to identify thousands of cases, 2,000 cases of progressive massive fibrosis in coal miners in Appalachia, in the same time frame that the government official count was only 99 cases nationwide. That was the first part of this investigation. I asked a question then. I said, well, how could this happen if the regulatory system and the laws and regulations and enforcement that were set up to prevent this were working? If all those things were working, this wouldn't have happened. You wouldn't have so many miners who are sick and dying. And they will all die from this disease or something related to it. And it's a horrific death. One scientist, a pulmonologist, described it as suffocating while alive. So I wanted to know how this could happen if this regulatory system that we had, you know, was working right. Well, what I discovered in the latest investigation that I conducted last year and part of the year before was that, in fact, government data of the sampling of coal mine dust in coal mines, which government inspectors go in, they test the coal mine dust, showed excessive amounts of dust, thousands and thousands of times, and especially the most toxic dust, which is silica, thousands and thousands of times in the last 30 years. This is the government's own data. Why they didn't see that in their data, I don't know, but it showed that their system didn't work the way it was supposed to a significant amount of the time. And that can help explain why the miners now are sick. And that also comes at the same time that mining has changed. So basically all the big coal seams in Appalachia are gone. The smaller seams that are left, they're embedded in sandstone or in rock. When you cut that rock to also mine the coal, you might have a coal seam that's only 18 inches thick, but your mining machine is 6 feet. So it's going to, you know, it's going to cut rock with the coal. The technology is such you can do that and separate the rock and the coal later. That generates an enormous amount of dust, and that dust, when it's cut, becomes includes silica particles. Silica is 20 times more toxic than coal dust alone. And so that, and we talked to dozens of coal miners about their experiences when they were mining, miners who are now sick with this disease. So that's what coal's deadly dust was all about, is not only this epidemiologists now consider an epidemic of this disease, but how it happened, what the regulatory failure was over the last at least 20 years, what could have been done about it and wasn't done about it.
You also covered mine disasters.
Yeah.
How does that compare with the last assignment that you just completed here?
Well, the 2010 Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia is what got me started on this path, actually. So that was an investigation of that mine disaster. What did the company do or not do that contributed to the explosion that killed 29 coal miners in West Virginia? And what were the what did the regulators do or not do that contributed to that situation that allowed the company to behave in the way it was and not fully protect those miners? That got me interested in two things. One, in that whole notion of regulatory failure. These regulatory agencies that regulate workplace safety exist to protect workers. Workers have a right to go to work every day and to go home healthy and alive. And if the regulators aren't doing their jobs fully, then those workers are at risk. That really intrigued me as I looked into what happened at the Upper Big Branch mine. So I got interested in workplace safety and in regulation, regulatory failures, but also the autopsies of the miners who were killed at Upper Big Branch revealed an extraordinarily high rate of black lung disease among those miners, including the younger miners who hadn't worked so many years underground. And that's what prompted our first investigation of the resurgence of black lung disease in 2012. And of course, my interest in black lung, you know, continued after that.
You recently participated in a panel discussion after showing the movie Coal's Deadly Dust in Whitesburg. Talk about that experience.
The Appalachian Citizens Law Center and Apple Shop in Whitesburg set up this screening of Coal's Deadly Dust. Whitesburg is in the heart of coal country in eastern Kentucky. We had on a panel the two coal miners who are featured in the film, both of whom have progressive massive fibrosis. Both of whom are suffering significantly from that disease, as well as other people who were in the film. And What was interesting about that screening, and we've done screenings in other parts of the country as well. What was interesting about that screening is that in the audience were a number of coal miners with oxygen tanks and tubes attaching the oxygen to their noses and who had black lung disease, and also the sort of the survivors, family members of miners who died from black lung. And I think because they saw the miners in the film telling their story, and then the miners were on the stage also telling their stories, had everybody in tears. The miners and the family members in the audience sort of felt permission. It was okay for them to talk about their stories. And so the question and answer session went on much longer than we anticipated because so many people wanted to not necessarily ask questions but tell their own stories. And they were heart-wrenching stories about Papa who died from black lung and watching them essentially, you know, suffocate to death, and miners who were trying to get benefits and couldn't and were running into resistance from the coal company that they had worked for. It was really a heart-wrenching sort of experience. And, you know, it's a tough thing when you do your reporting, especially in radio, and it's sort of anonymous and it goes out and then, you know, you don't get instantaneous feedback. And here we were showing this film in the heart of the area where this epidemic was taking place. In the audience were people who were wrapped up in it. And it was gratifying that they appreciated, you know, what we were doing, the reporting we did, the exposure we gave to that issue, and giving them the ability to talk about it as well.
The power of journalism. I mean, the mission and the responsibility was right there in front of you.
This is, you know, this happened again a few weeks ago. We did a screening in southwestern Virginia in Big Stone Gap. And again, it was an audience that had a mix of people who are interested in the black lung issue, but minors who have the disease. And a widow of one miner stood up and after we showed the film and she just said, thank you. You know, thank you for showing the rest of the country what we're going through here. And a miner got up and said the same thing. We're misunderstood here. People don't know what we're going through. That's really true about Appalachia in general and coal mining and coal miners in particular. One thing I found in my reporting over the years is that this is a region that, you know, you get reporters, national reporters parachuting into the region, picking up stereotypes, portraying people in ways that, you know, that are not necessarily accurate or complimentary. Coal miners are, I think, among the most dismissed people in workers in our country, unfairly, of course, and not a lot of understanding about what goes on in Appalachia outside of the region. So I think it's really important to do these kinds of stories, to have a presence. To you know, I'm one of those parachuting reporters in the sense that I'm not from here, but I have been back a lot. I've been in and out of Appalachia. I couldn't tell you how many times in the last 8 years reporting these stories. And the producer and director of the film, Coal's Deadly Dust, Elaine McMillian Sheldon, is a coal miner's daughter, grew up in Logan, West Virginia, in a coal mining town. Her brother still mines. Her cousins still mine. She had a connection to the region and to coal mining in a way that I don't viscerally have. So that was really helpful in the production of the film. She could talk to coal miners in ways that I couldn't. But I'm really grateful to the miners who talked to us. Over 34 miners we interviewed in depth, probed their lives and their medical situations and their workplace histories. And every one of them was just grateful that we were willing to tell their stories.
Now, you recently retired from NPR. Let me ask you, when you were working on this story, did you know that this was going to be your last major story for the network?
I had decided in the middle of last year that I was going to retire. And so I knew this was my last big project for NPR. and having the PBS Frontline film as part of that. I knew that I was already into the project anyway, but I knew that my timeline was such that this would be the last big thing I would do. And so it was important for me to make it as meaningful a project as I could. And I'm happy to report that there are some things going on as a result of the project. There is consideration of legislation. The House Labor Committee has talked about writing legislation to correct some of the things that we exposed. The Mine Safety and Health Administration, after much pressure from black lung scientists and from advocates for coal miners, has decided to issue a request for information about the way that they regulate exposure to silica dust. That's underway right now. I think we have given the scientific community the permission, essentially, room to do more scientific work, more studies. There are a number of studies have been done that have confirmed what we have reported, plus other studies are underway to get at what's really going on here, which will add a lot of information that eventually could help protect miners and guide government policy. So there are things that have happened, and I feel good about that. I don't think they're happening fast enough, and I don't think yet that we've seen a commitment either from the Congress or from the administration to jump in and really do something about this quickly.
Is it fair to say that in some ways coal might be the third rail of politics, the new third rail of politics, Brian?
I don't know if it's a third rail, but coal is a political football, that's for sure. Coal and coal miners. So you have a situation in this state in particular in which Kentucky has one of the single most powerful people in Washington, Senator Mitch McConnell, who has not exhibited much sympathy or certainly not proceeded with much action on behalf of coal miners suffering from black lung disease, helping them make sure their benefits continue. There are a bunch of issues around black lung disease that are percolating in Washington. But there hasn't been much, dozens of coal miners went to Washington to lobby members of Congress and meet with them, miners with black lung disease, dragging oxygen tanks, Mitch McConnell met with them for a couple of minutes. And many of them were quite offended by that. So there is not the reaction to coal miners that there is to the coal industry. Many miners have said to me they now understand that the phrase friends of coal doesn't necessarily mean friends of coal miners, given the struggles that they have to obtain benefits, to keep their benefits, to keep their pension plan going, to make sure that the Black Lung Trust Fund that provides them benefits is fully funded in an ongoing and secure way, and to have a government response to black lung disease. Miners themselves are starting, to say this. Third rail, I don't know, but definitely political football. You see the president, campaigning to coal miners and holding rallies in West Virginia and in coal country and trying, saying he's going to revive coal and restore jobs, which hasn't happened, and that has a lot to do with the economics of coal more than anything else. But what has been done to help coal miners who are suffering and dying and who need help and the benefits, not much is happening on that front.
All right. As we mentioned, you have since retired. Who do you pass the baton to tell these stories?
Well, the great news is that there are fantastic young reporters in the pipeline doing great work. In particular, on coal mining issues, Sydney Bowles, who works out of WMMT and the Ohio Valley Resource, a consortium of stations in Kentucky, West Virginia, and Ohio, Sydney has been picking up this Bhutan. I've worked with her directly on some stories, and she's been covering the coal miners who have blocked this coal train after this coal company went bankrupt, and the paychecks of the miners bounced, so they blocked a coal train that was coming out of that coal company's facility, and highlighting their protest. Her reporting has triggered a whole bunch of national reporting by national news outlets. She's this, really talented young reporter who is trying to own this. And there are other reporters out there at Ohio Valley Resource in West Virginia as well and in Kentucky who are doing stories. So hopefully, I don't have any doubt that there will continue to be, good, solid investigative reporting on these issues, because I see it in these younger reporters. And they don't, they don't skip a beat. I have 38 years of experience doing this stuff, but I have seen from these young reporters what looks to me like, oh, they've had years and years and years of experience because they do the job well. In fact, some of them have, had maybe less than a year or two of experience, but they've got good reporting instincts. They are empathetic. They dig deep. They write well. They report well. So I don't have any doubt that this stuff will continue to be covered, and soon I will be forgotten.
Radio listeners, NPR listeners, or just radio listeners in general, they really don't see everything behind the scenes of what it takes to bring a story to a radio audience. I want you to just maybe spend a couple of minutes talking about that editorial process and what it's like to work with your engineers and your news directors and copy editors and all of that.
Well, at NPR, still, we're a big news organization. And most recently, I worked for the investigations unit at NPR. And there is an editor there, and there is a senior editor and a senior producer and data people, one data reporter. And then we have resources of the rest of the company and that sort of thing. But largely, I have worked by myself for 38 years. I've worked at home. I used to joke that I needed to retire in order to spend less time with my family because I worked at home. That's not true, by the way. As my wife will say, I still haven't spent enough time with my family, and she's very happy I'm retired. But so a lot of it, it's a very lonely process, especially I haven't been based in Washington all these years. But yes, there is a rigor that is applied. So in the case of investigative reporting, I'll spend months and months gathering data, looking and these will be spreadsheets with millions of lines of information. We'll get documents through the Freedom of Information Act or through sources. We'll get documents, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages of documents that we go through. We do background interviews with people to understand what's going on, and then we do interviews, for air. So you have to take all of this information and these interviews that you've gathered, and you have to make sense of them, right? And so that's the biggest challenge, which elements of those interviews do you use in your story? How do you convey the data and the documents in a way that doesn't bore people to death? A lot of that I'm doing. I might have somebody I'm working with, a producer. On this last project, I had a data producer basically who managed all the data stuff, and she's fantastic. Name is Huo Jingnan. And But largely I was writing on my own, and then eventually I would go to the editor, and the producer, and I would present my audio and my script, and we would go through it, and we would have multiple edits. And at NPR, it's a very rigorous process. There's fact checking. We have a researcher at the investigations team who does fact checking, and you go through layers of edits with senior news managers. They want to know. One, they want it to have journalistic integrity, but they also want to make sure that it's nailed tight in terms of legally, are we going to get sued over this? We have lawyers who go through the stories and we'll do edits. And so it's an enormously rigorous process, and it's good. I mean, it's painful as you go through it, but you want a story that is solid, you know, and you know, no one has questioned the facts, the findings of these stories that we've done in the last few years. They might not have been happy about what we reported, but they have been unable to raise any serious questions about the facts, the data, you know, what we found. And so it's a good process in that way. What listeners may not realize too is, you know, we edit on computers. You know, we have software that we edit on, and so, you know, we're pulling from interviews those bits that will help tell the story. It's incumbent upon us to not distort in that process, to maintain context. That is something that we agonize over as we work. And really, whether I'm doing a story that I'm going to turn around for the same day, it's 2 minutes long or 4 minutes long, or whether I've spent a year on a story and I'm getting 20 minutes of airtime over, you know, multiple stories over several days, you're really doing the same thing, just maybe a smaller scale on the shorter story. But you bring the same rigor to it. There's an editor who reviews every script, every story, and a producer who makes sure there's quality in the audio.
Final question, Howard. Why public radio?
You know, I started out at a small public radio station in Oregon. I was a volunteer. I was looking for something else to do. I was kind of changing careers. And what really intrigued me the most was the power of the human voice. And what I love about public radio is that we have time to feature people telling their stories, and we can hear in their voices the emotion. We can hear the inflection. That is just a really powerful thing. And then we have the ability to record action, sound, create scenes like they do in television, except these scenes you see in your head. And that's a really active kind of comprehension of something, you know, that radio draws you in. It happens inside your head. And I think that's a really compelling way to tell stories. You know, it's one thing to read a quote from somebody. It's another thing to hear them say it and to hear the inflection in their voice, to hear their accent, to know they come from somewhere, to hear the pain or the humor or the joy or the suffering. You know, you can't convey that in print in the same way that you can in audio. And so that's what really has attracted me to radio and audio, but to public radio, because we can get the time to tell stories, and we can tell those kinds of stories. There isn't anybody else who does what we do. There's more of it now happening in the podcast world, and people are copying what we do. You know, NPR is the single biggest producer of podcasts news podcasts on the planet. Others are jumping into that game, but they're mimicking what we do because I just think it's an incredibly powerful medium. And I've been so lucky in my career because I've gotten the airtime to tell these stories, to expose people to these voices, to take people to these places that I've been to.
Well, Howard Berkus, we thank you for your work on behalf of NPR and public radio. And we thank you for stopping by, and congratulations on the Tom and Pat Gish Award. Well earned, and best of luck to you.
Well, thank you very much.